We'll just start with the before teaching prayers. In the Buddha Dhamma and Sangha, until enlightened I seek refuge through giving and other perfections, to aid all may I become Buddha. In the Buddha Dharma and Sangha, until enlightened I seek refuge through giving and other perfections, to aid all may I become Buddha. In the Buddha Dharma and Sangha, until enlightened I seek refuge through giving and other perfections, to aid all may I become Buddha. Sentient beings, to be free from all the wrong views, from correct devotion, from incorrect devotion to the virtuous friend, up to the unified state of Vajjarahood. May all, myself and all sentient beings, be complete, gain all the realizations of the path, from guru devotion up to the unified state of Vajjarahood. And may all sentient beings be free of all the obstacles along the way. Idam Guru Ratnam Andalakam Niryatayami. Beyond speech, thought, expression, wisdom gone beyond. Discerning transcendent wisdom's sphere of awareness. Homage to the mother of three times Buddhas. And then remembering Buddha Shakyamuni, and whether Prajnaparamita, just heart, then we'll recite Buddhist mantra seven times and experience the blessing pouring into us so that we may actualize these teachings. clearing away every obstacle. Taya Tao Muni Muni Maha. To tame my mind completely, like all the past great beings have done. We're going to complete our studies of the 7-point mind training with the motivation to incorporate them not just into our minds but into our actions, into our heart, and thereby become better people on the path to enlightenment. And may these by our example, may we inspire others as well to enter the path to enlightenment. So, here we are. We haven't talked all day. Has anybody got something to say? Any questions that came up in the night or anything?
Well, it was interesting. I was just watching some of Rinpoche from Singapore, and he he went, oh, well, you know how he does.
Yeah.
He says it over and over and over.
Yeah.
That whatever we do and whatever mantras we say and whatever practice we do for the world, whatever, it's not Dharma practice unless we dedicate. He said it.
Yeah, no, he's been saying that a lot. Yeah.
So I just thought, because we have talked about that, so I thought, oh, he said it for about 15 minutes.
Yeah.
So,
just thought. So at least if we can remember at the end of the day, to dedicate, you know, what we've done. Because it's, I mean, we talked about it just last night. Unless you put that virtue in your merit bank, it's just going to go somewhere else. You know, you have to direct where your virtue goes, you know. So, yeah. Even if you're doing it for somebody else, you know, if you're trying to help somebody else with your practice, your prayer, still you dedicate it to, you know, their well-being, but also for you to attain enlightenment for all sentient beings. Okay, we've got one chapter left. So, and that probably won't take too long. It depends. So, let's just read that one all together. Actually, let's read the whole thing. It'd be nice to read it from start to finish. And as we read it, we'll just kind of reflect on the meaning and what we've talked about the last 3 days, and rejoicing that we've had this opportunity. Homage to great compassion. The essence of nectar-like instruction is transmitted from Sirlingpa. It is like a diamond, like the sun, and like a medicinal tree. Does everybody remember? Diamond, sun. It's okay, I won't stop. The meaning of the text shall be known. The development of the five degenerations will be transformed into the path to enlightenment. 1. The preliminary practices of training the mind. First, learn the preliminaries. 2. Training in the two bodhicittas. A. training in conventional bodhicitta, gather all blame into one. Meditate on the great kindness of all. Train alternately in giving and taking. Begin the sweekens by taking from your own side. Mount these two upon the breath. The three objects, the three poisons, and the three virtuous roots are the brief instruction for the subsequent attainment. To remember this, train in every activity by words. B. Training in ultimate bodhicitta. Show the secret to the one who has achieved stability. Think that all phenomena are like dreams. Analyze the unborn nature of awareness or cognition. Even the antidote is free from existing from its own side. Place the actual path on the basis of all. Between sessions, consider all phenomena are illusory. 3. Transforming adverse conditions into the path to enlightenment. When the container and the contents are filled with evil, transform adverse conditions into the path to enlightenment. Apply meditation to whatever circumstances you meet. Applying the four preparations is the supreme method. 4. How to integrate all our daily practices. This brief essential instruction should be applied with the five forces. The five forces are the most important practice of the instructions of Mahayana transference. 5. The measurement of success in training the mind. All Dharma is condensed into one purpose. Hold to the principle of the two witnesses. Always rely on a happy mind alone. The indication of having trained is reversal. The sign of having trained is possessing the five greatnesses. One is trained if one is able to practice when distracted. 6. The commitments of training the mind. Always train in the three general points. Do not allow your mind training to cause inappropriate behavior. Do not allow your mind training to contradict your vows. Do not practice mind training with partiality. Remain natural while changing your aspirations. Do not speak about degenerated limbs. Never think about others' faults. Purify your greatest illusion first. Abandon hope for results. Abandon poisonous food. Do not follow delusions. Do not retaliate to verbal abuse. Do not wait in ambush. Do not offend others. Do not transfer your own faults or burdens onto others. Do not misuse the Dharma. Do not aim at being the first to get the best. Do not turn a god into a demon. Do not seek happiness by causing unhappiness to others. 7. The precepts of training the mind. Do all yogas by one. Perform every suppression of interference by one. The two activities, one at the beginning and one at the end. Endure both whatever arises. Guard both as you would your life. Train in the three difficulties. Practice the three main causes. Become acquainted with the three non-degenerations. Possess the three inseparables. Train with bias towards the objects. It is important to train deeply and encompass all. Always meditate on special cases. Do not rely upon other conditions. Apply the principle practice at this time. Do not misinterpret. Do not be erratic. Release by two, investigation and analysis. Do not be boastful. Do not get angry. Do not be unstable. Do not wish for gratitude. Because of my wishes, having endured suffering and a bad reputation, I received the instructions for controlling self-grasping. Now, if I die, I have no regrets. Okay. Do all yogas by one. Does anybody have a stab at what that one means? Yeah. Or were you going to say something, Pauline?
I was thinking, do all the yogas by one, practice the Dharma in everything you do.
Yeah, and also abandon self-cherishing. That one, most important one, is abandon self-cherishing, because in the beginning we can't really abandon self-grasping. It's hard. I mean, we can try, but the main thing is abandoning self-cherishing. And really have to think about what that is, because I still don't like that word. I think it's self-preoccupation's better. Just being completely concerned with yourself, you know. Because to cherish yourself is a good thing. So I think that that's kind of a mistranslation again. It has kind of a punitive feeling about it, you know. We need to get away from that. Okay, perform every suppression of interference by one. Well, it's the same one, you know. But I like your interpretation, Pauline. It could be just by Dharma practice, you know. But I think they meant here by this one thing of reversing it being all about you, you know. And that's a better interpretation is just taking things personally. You know, when things happen badly, we always kind of, either good or bad, you know, it's like, it's a personal affront, you know. And just, the main thing is what we were talking about before, about just realize that it's just karma ripening, you know, good or bad. But when things bad happen, or a lot of times things that happen to us, we take personally when they haven't been directed at us at all, you know. So I think that's something to think about, a different interpretation of that, you know. It's not about me, you know. It's just about somebody else's trouble that I happen to be mixed up in, you know. And as soon as I think it's about me, that's when all my other afflictions come in. So if you can just see things as, you know, causes, conditions ripening and dissolving, then and not have you in the center of it all, then it's a whole lot easier to let go of things. There are two activities, one at the beginning and one at the end. So, yes, that one. Barbara knows. Motivation and dedication.
Probably got motivation and dedication, yeah.
Motivation and dedication. So always at the beginning we motivate to attain enlightenment, at the end we dedicate. And if you can remember it, you know, with your meals or, you know, you can do it as often as possible, but at least in the morning and night, you know. Try to wake up and go, today I'm going to do my best, you know, to keep my motivation to attain enlightenment for all sentient beings. It's pretty simple, you know. And this one is, endure both, whatever arises. That's like good and bad. You know, don't get too excited, you know, when the good things happen. You know, so much grasping about the good things, and don't get too... Because it's all, again, you know, it's not personal. It's just karma arising, and I just happen to have these things, you know, so... It's not that we become, you know, a lot of people think unattached means you're not happy, you don't have joy anymore. It's not that. It's just that there's not so much grasping at it, you know. And in fact, if you see advanced beings, you know, they're just joyful all the time. Because once that sense of I is lightened, you know, we talked yesterday about the burden of ego, you know, the more, and I said it's quite gradual, you know, the more you chip away at that, you know, Michelangelo and his David inside, you know, the more we chip away at self-cherishing and self-grasping, the lighter and lighter our mind becomes. And so, because if we're grasping at anything, we're grasping, you know, and I think one of the things we grasp at strongly is when we have joyful, happy experiences, which is why it's so painful when we lose them. So it's an interesting exercise to allow yourself to be happy without, you know, clamping on it, you know, my happiness, you know, but just happy, you know.
So that's just like being in the moment.
Yeah, isn't it?
But yeah. Then the moment is impermanent.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's
like... Yeah. And guard both as you would your life. So that means... guarding our commitments to this practice, and then your general commitments, like if you have mantra commitments, or, you know, just guarding your commitments that you've made to the Buddhas, or especially to yourself, you know. Because really all these commitments, the teachers and the Buddha, they don't care. I mean, they do care. They care a lot. But I mean, it's not like they're upsetter. You know, it's for you, you know. The reason I'm keeping my commitments is because I want to attain enlightenment. It's not because I'm going to get spanked if I don't, you know. I mean, it's funny, but we still kind of carry those things, you know, from childhood that I've got to do this because otherwise I'll be a bad kid or be a bad person. You'd be surprised how much of that's still in us, you know. Because those imprints we receive when we're tiny people, they're very deep. Which is why they're so hard to get rid of. Maybe Carl understands more about how it works neurologically, but so don't get too hung up about this kind of I've got to do this or else kind of, you know. I guess you know what I mean, right? Yeah. Okay. This one is good. Train in the three difficulties. Okay, well, the first difficulty that we've talked about quite a bit is recognizing the delusion when it arises, which is why I've said how important it is to develop awareness. And I thought about it yesterday and the day before, and I haven't, and I've neglected to mention it because I was kind of putting down, you know, reciting prayers. It's really good to recite prayers, but if you're trying to, what I was saying is if you're trying to develop awareness, it doesn't necessarily help that. But it does, you know, because I thought about it, because if your mind's wandering, you know, you're going to bring your mind back to the recitation as well. So I wouldn't be too down on recitation, because for some people that's a good way to develop awareness, you know. So it can be the most skillful method, you know. And I remember when I first went to my first retreat with Lama Yeshe, and it was a Chinrezig retreat, and I found it so helpful because when I was younger and people were starting to like go to TM meditation and Zen practice and things like that, I had such a busy mind, and I had that wrong concept that meditation means you have to stop your thoughts, you know. I figured I'd never really be able to meditate, you know. And but when I went to a tantric retreat, it was like, wow, they're giving my mind something to do. Mm-hmm. And I was really happy because then I could do something I didn't have to worry about that mind. And so, and through, you know, these having, like I spoke about yesterday afternoon, kind of alternating between, you know, a tantric visualization and then stabilization, a tantric meditation, now I can easily sit and not have anything to do, you know, with my mind. I'm really happy just, you know, watching my mind, nothing. But when I first started, it was just torturous, you know. But it's interesting, I know other people, they're just the opposite. They would never want to do a tantric practice, and all they want to do is sit and watch their breath. I mean, I have, you know, Kagyu friends that are like that, which is why they're more attracted to the Kagyu tradition, because they just do a lot more of that, you know, or the Zen tradition. So, you know, rather than saying one is bad and one is good, I mean, the reason that we have all these different methods is whatever works for you to make you sit down and look at your mind, you know. I think that's for us to figure out. So recognizing delusions, I think one of the first steps is figuring out what's the best method to help me recognize a delusion, you know. And even if it's very difficult for you to, you know, meditate and watch your mind while you're sitting, some people do it while they're swimming or while they're running or, you know, doing Qigong or... But I think it's important to recognize where we are in our particular mental inner environment, you know, and not try to do something that's too hard. Find something that you're comfortable doing. And if you're only comfortable doing it for 5 minutes, that's okay. Do it for 5 minutes, you know, if you want to watch your breath for 5 minutes. Because 5 minutes will be easy. And then in a few months, 10 minutes will be easy, you know. But I think so many of us, because we're given these templates from teachers, you know, you have to do this, that we force ourselves, we kind of squeeze our mind to fit that template, and it doesn't fit. And so then we don't have a good experience, and then it just becomes work. So it's really important to find and trust ourselves enough, you know, trust our motivation enough to know that this works for me. And if you have a sudden commitment, and it's too difficult, make it very simple. You can make them very simple. You don't have to do all the different words, you know, as long as you have the essence of it. And, you know, recite the mantra, whatever. So I think that's a really important thing. And find out which practice kind of you feel good about. You know, maybe it's doing prostrations. I don't know, you know. But it's good to have, if you can, you know, decide, okay, I'm going to do a little bit of Dharma practice every day, 10 minutes maybe, or whatever you can do. And then it gradually builds up rather than, you know, trying to force yourself to do something. Because you never, and the other thing I didn't mention for the new people, it's really good, really helpful to set aside a place in your room for your Dharma practice instead of just on the bed that you share with your partner or whatever. But see, like a little corner there, you know, you can put yourself a little table and a little place to sit. And if you need a chair rather than sitting on a cushion, just have a little place where you put up some things. It doesn't even have to be Buddhist, but things that kind of are your personal photographs or rocks or feathers or candles or whatever it is that kind of like, this is my place where I go to be safe and, you know, work on myself, and it's nobody else's place, you know. It's really important to, I think anyway, to have a space like that, you know. And not just like, you know, something on the kitchen wall, you know, or some people just have on their dining room table, you know, a little candle or something, but a place that's actually reserved for you. It's like your laboratory, you know. And so that, do you agree, Barbara?
Yeah. I used to have, when I shared a house, I had a, there was like a dresser, and it had a pull down where you put the whiskey and stuff.
Yeah.
So I made my shrine in there, because then it didn't affect the other people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can just hide.
I have a friend that makes it their closet. Yeah. I have a friend, wherever he goes, he makes his shrine in his closet, so nobody ever sees it, and he just shuts the door, you know, and he goes in, and you know, when he's meditating, has the door open, so it's not, you know. But, you know, he goes in his closet. I mean, sure, there's some clothes. I don't know if he keeps his clothes in there, too. But so it's a little, you know, space. It's his, like, his little cave where he goes. And wherever he moves, he does that, you know.
In hospital, I did it in my, you know, the little thing you have beside your bed. And I had it inside there.
Yeah.
So I could see it. And yeah. Didn't bother anybody.
Yeah, those little bedside tables. Yeah. I have, like, I have one here, you know, that has a little hole in it, you know. Yeah. A little shelf at the bottom of the drawer or something, you know. And if you don't want other people to see it, all you have to do is get a pretty cloth and cover it when you're not using it. You know, if you want to have a little statue or a photograph or something, you know. And I think the other thing is helpful too for our minds is to make a little offering every day. You know, light the candle or light the incense or put the flower or offer a cookie. It's just helpful to make an offering and a little request, you know, that it reminds you. It also helps create positive potential, but it's also remembering that the Buddha and the deities and everything, they're only there as reflections of what we're trying to grow in ourselves. So when you're making that offering, you're also offering it to your future attainments, you know, and to remind yourself that I have the Buddha nature inside of me, you know. I can see my David inside my piece of granite, you know. I might not have it exactly clear what it is yet, but I know I'm headed for it, you know. And so those Buddha images, and if a female one, if you're a woman and you like a female one better, I mean, you know, that's why I picked Buddha and Prajnaparamita, because it's a male and a female at one time, you know. And, you know, you can, whatever. I mean, it's up to you to sort of sort it out, but make it personal and make it something that you find beautiful, you know. So, okay, recognize delusion. That's all about how to help us recognize delusion. And also, you know, I wanted to kind of give a pat on the back or a recognition of Western psychology. Because when you read the Lam Rim, they talk about five delusions, you know, ignorance, hatred, greed, pride, and jealousy. And it's so much more nuanced than that. You know, and we have all these traumas and all these different neuroses or what does Jung call them? I can't remember what Jung calls them at the moment, but these patterns, you know, our patterns of behavior.
Archetypes.
What? Archetypes. No, just our delusions, you know. complexes, yeah, the different complexes yeah. that we have. And so, like, if I were to write another Lam Rim, that little chapter on how delusions arise, you know, you could just put in a whole book on Western psychology. And so I did mention some books that can help, you know, with these. John Wellwood is another good Buddhist psychologist. John Wellwood and Mark Epstein and, of course, Danny Goleman's books. And I think Tara Brach, I think, maybe writes good books about it. And, of course, you can... Reading Carl Jung is really helpful. And Rob Preece's books and Robert Johnson's books, those very simple ones, he, she, and we. And do you have any other suggestions? Carl, you're a psychologist, to sort of...
No, I would certainly include those.
Yeah.
And not specifically Buddhist ones.
Yeah, but it doesn't have to be Buddhist.
Yeah.
Hmm? Maybe, yeah, Piaget, or, and I talked about Alice Miller and John Bradshaw, kind of classic.
Asangioli.
Asangioli?
Yeah, who was an Italian psychiatrist.
Yeah.
He developed the notion of transpersonal psychology.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's all good. That's really good stuff, too. And, yeah, there's others I can't think of now, but... because it's just helpful to kind of... know what your particular style is, you know, and I don't know, I've just found it all very helpful in recognizing delusions. And then the next one is applying antidotes. So one of the things we've talked about at the beginning is how important it is to develop loving kindness for yourself, because what we were just talking about, all this psychology, all these different patterns that we developed in childhood, we obviously had the karma from past lives to do that, you know. And so working with the Tonglin is a really good really good antidote with yourself. I find it been really helpful to me. And I can't remember, did I talk about... yeah, I did, I think, about... Like, you can work with your inner child. You know, you can have your inner child in your heart and you do tonglen with the inner child. And after a while, you can just stop and listen. Really give that little person a chance to say all the things that they didn't get to say because their parents are like, you can't, you know. And it's so healing, you know, to let that stuff come out. Because so many of our delusions, according to the... I really appreciate Jung's idea that it's shadow, you know. Things that we weren't allowed to feel or express are then become in our unconscious, and we're not aware of them. And what happens is we act out stuff, and we completely don't even know we're doing it. I know myself, lots of people, you know, this strange behavior, you know, you try really hard to practice Dharma, and then something happens, and you can't apply the antidote, you don't even recognize the delusion, because suddenly you're just like acting out something that... you know, wasn't healed from your childhood, or maybe even from a past life. So I've found that a really helpful to do that practice. And I found that that Homecoming book by John Bradshaw was helpful in identifying what I needed at those stages of my development. Maybe Piaget does that too. And because... having been around the Dharma world for 40 years now, you know, and watching people that have done it for 40 years now who can't apply the antidotes, and we're given these antidotes, but they're all sort of, you know, intellectual, and if we don't see what we're in denial of, we can't apply the antidote. So it's important to understand that and to heal that, and whether you can do it by yourself or you need to go to a therapist or just talk to a friend. Friends are really good, you know. Who was it that you have your two... Is it you have your two friends? No, you have your two friends that you can call, you know. I think that's really helpful to have Sangha and know that you're not alone, you know. And so applying the antidotes... I mean, it's really good to study classic Dharma, you know. And when you're angry, you try to be patient. And when you have attachment, you think about, you know, the disadvantages of attachment. And definitely, it's helpful over and over again to recollect on your own terms, on your own time, the disadvantages of cherishing myself over others, you know, and the advantage of cherishing others. But that's after we develop a healthy sense of taking care of ourselves, you know. Yeah, there's a lot to be learned about the concept of self-cherishing, self-preoccupation, and what that really is, and how we have wrong views about it. You know, how we can just use it to continue to put ourselves down and not take care of ourselves. Because it's not about that, you know. So, what are the... Anyone else want to add to the antidotes, how we apply antidotes? And don't forget the physical antidotes. You know, we've done Qigong, we've done two or three healing exercises, because the mind rides on the wind. So if you're really stuck, you know, work with your winds. Or work with your winds every day. You'll have less delusions. You know? You'll just feel... Because, you know, even if you just feel better, you know when you don't feel good, it's harder not to feel sorry for yourself. It's harder to stop yourself from snapping at people. So the thing about... it's harder for you to resist compulsive buying, you know, because you don't feel good and you feel better, you know. But if you do Qigong, you just feel better. And then you just naturally feel more content. And when you feel more content, less delusions arise, you know. Yeah.
Do you think if you do like practices like Shina, for example, do you think you'd arrive at the same place that the kind of more Western psychology practices would take you to, just naturally, or would it be quite possible to bypass some of that work as a Westerner?
I think there's a term called spiritual bypassing, which I think some people misunderstand, because I saw YouTube about it, and John Wellwood, I think, coined the term, and it means that because you're doing the spiritual work, that you do have these things in denial. And so, therefore, they're coming out. They still, just what I was talking about, spiritual bypassing is when you don't have the psychology, the complexes are still there. And so, no matter how much practice you've done, because you haven't touched those things, they still come out, and you can't apply the antidote. And my feeling about it is that, I'll answer your question in a minute, is that a combination is really good. I know in my life, I use Western psychology, but then like doing the purification practices where you regret, you know, you take refuge, you regret, then you do an action and you vow never to do it again. That those practices of purification and accumulation, and this is just my experience and my view, you know, that by doing those practices, you give yourself the merit, the positive potential for the psychology then to shift. Because I think they really work together well, because I think if you don't work with the complexes, you are going to get into spiritual bypassing. And maybe you can sit really well, but the teachings talk about then a rat comes along, you get angry at it and you lose it, you know. And so I'm not sure you can get there with Shina. I think if you could get all the way there, to the point where you completely obliterated self-cherishing and self-grasping through Shine, then you would, you know, and you wouldn't have to do psychological work, because by the time you stop self-grasping, there's no I for spiritual bypassing to grab hold to, you know. But I my feeling is you'll get there faster, because you'll be able to create more merit, because you'll be creating less negative karma along the way if you can have the awareness of how you screw up, you know. And so I think it's good to do both. And so doing things like Vajrasattva retreat and mandala offerings and refuge practices and mantra recitation all give the enough power in the mind to purify those things. Because all they are karmas that need purifying. And I think with, apologies to the psychology world. I know a lot of people doing 30 years of therapy and they're still just as messed up as they ever were. They just have this whole new jargon for describing how messed up they are. And so I think that then where Buddhism comes in is we understand the concept of karma very well. Maybe we don't, but, you know, there, at least theoretically we understand karma, and we understand the karma that it takes I mean, that concept, it takes karma, it takes good karma to mitigate bad karma, to make it very simple. You know, it's like a scale, you know. You've got this scale, and here you are weighted down with all your spiritual bypassing complexes, and the more, and this is your merit over here, and the more you dharma practice, it starts to go like this, so that the weight of your virtue starts to overcome the weight of your delusional complexes, you know. And so, especially people who've had real bad trauma, I think that, you know, EMDR and the tapping and these kinds of things would really streamline their dharma practice. They work. I know so many people who come to the dharma because, you know, I always tell directors, you know, the percentage of population of, you know, disturbed, depressed people is about, you know, is a lot greater in the dharma center than it is in the greater population. So you have to be prepared to be working with hurt, damaged people because they're coming to the dharma looking for help, you know. And so the good thing is that if you can help them with recognizing the trauma and guide them to some kind of trauma therapy, which is why I'm more and more interested in it all the time, because I see so many dharma students that really need that, because otherwise they so misunderstand self-cherishing and different things, you know, and they try so hard and still, you know, it doesn't really work so well for them. And so I really believe that we're living in a, if we can live longer, you know, kind of a good time of when Dharma comes to the West, this meeting of both of them, you know, because the times are so much more degenerate. You know, I don't think that when Buddha was walking around 2,500 years ago, people were as traumatized. You know, for one thing, wars lasted 15 minutes. You know, they just go fight, bang, 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 over. You know, now wars last decades. And so we have, like, generations of traumatized people. You know? And the other really interesting thing is trauma works through generations. You know, there are people that's really fascinating. People like second-generation Jews in New York City who completely lose it when they get to be 22 years old because that's when their mother was put in the concentration camp. You know, there's a DNA that's passed, you know, and homeopathy is working. There's homeopathic remedies. Oh, don't forget about homeopathy. It's great. Homeopathy, flower remedies. You know, I've tried everything. And in my long retreats, the first one I did use a lot of homeopathic remedies. The second one I used a lot of flower remedies. And they really, really help. And so, I don't know, maybe that's enough to say about that. But so antidotes, apply the antidotes, you know. So the antidotes are purifying and accumulating, you know, and requesting. The three things we've talked about, you know, you can make a specific request, you know. I want to heal that. I want to heal that thing that happened to me. You know, I want to heal that sexual abuse that happened to me when I was three. You know, and work with it. And when traumas are really intense, those kind of traumas, you know, I think you do need a therapist. You know, because they're so painful when they come up. You know. But Lama Yeshe said many times. He said, "There's nothing that can't be purified." You know, and. So, yeah, so recognize delusion, apply the antidotes. So I think we have a lot more antidotes at our disposal now than just what's written in the Lam Rim, you know. And I encourage you to investigate and see what kind of, you have a resonate, you know, something that you resonate with. And, yeah, I think the flower remedies, not just Bach flower remedies, there's lots of flower remedies. And when I was in retreat, you know, you can work on things so much better. It's like you really go into this laboratory. And I used to feel when I would take them, because you take them like for about a month, you know, and I'd be sitting there meditating, and I would know, you know, each one has a specific thing, you know, like I can't remember what they were now, but you know, and you can use that in your meditation when you want to be in the beginning when you're purifying stuff. And it was interesting because I would just feel this kind of like vibration go through my body. And then something would happen, and I would know that was gone, and it would be gone. And just to, I'm not saying this to, you know, pat myself on the back, but I discovered when I was moving last year, this list of everything. It was about 25 things about myself that I wanted to change, you know, that I wrote before my second long retreat. And all but one, there just weren't issues anymore, you know. So, and the reason I'm saying this is because Dharma really works, you know. It's that thing that Harry Sutton said about in the beginning, you know, you're the car on a motorway full of hundreds of vehicles, you know, stuck in a traffic jam. And after Vajrasattva retreat, you're the only car on the highway. Just go wherever you want, you know. And to have that kind of freedom, you know, it's just wonderful, you know. So anyway, apply antidotes. And the last one is uproot completely. So that's like realizing emptiness, isn't it? So even though we're doing relative antidotes with psychology and Buddhism, it's always important, if you can, every session to end with a meditation on emptiness. Even though you don't really get it. But just because you may really get it. But intellectually, it's not hard to understand. And this book is really good for, I think, emptiness. And the other thing I didn't tell you that I wanted to say is the Dalai Lama wrote a book a long time ago. I think it was in the 70s. It's called The Key to the Majjhimika. And it's not very long. I think you can still find it. But he wrote it specifically for Westerners about emptiness. And when I was first entering the Dharma, I read it quite a few times, and it was really, really helpful. So The Key to the Majjhimika, because Majjhimika is the name of the philosophy that describes emptiness, you know. He's so kind. And it's not even very long. It's like 30 pages or something, you know. Sometimes it comes in a book, you know, like with other teachings or whatever. Because that's the ultimate antidote, you know. And just knowing that helps. Okay, let's keep going. Well, that was a long one. Okay. Become acquainted with the three non-degenerations. I skipped one. Practice the three main causes. Okay, so the three main causes are the wish, the aspiration to practice Dharma, relying on a spiritual friend, having a teacher that you can rely on, and having the necessary conditions. So as best as you can, whatever, however much, you know, good karma you have, to have the conditions to practice. And if you don't have good conditions to practice, then pray really hard to get them, you know. The thing about why Lama Zopa is saying dedicate is because if you dedicate, then whatever virtue you're doing, even if it's just looking after your grandchild or whatever your job is, you know, working for the charity, but if you dedicate, because it's all virtuous, because you're doing it for some, you know, you're doing it for somebody else, you're creating, then if you dedicate it, you can dedicate to very specific things. Like I used to dedicate it that I could get into a long retreat. I did that for 10 years, you know. And then it just happened, you know. The causes and conditions came together. So don't think it doesn't work. It really works, you know. But the thing we have to do, we have to remember. And so as long as our dedications are for the ultimate goal of enlightenment, we can dedicate that, you know, I need more income, or I need a room where I can meditate, or, you know, I need a babysitter, or I need a whatever you need to help you practice Dharma. And Green Tara is really helpful for that. I always pray to Green Tara when I need material support. Because, you know, a lot of us misconstrue this Dharma thing, you know, I'm not allowed to ask anything for myself, or it's not true, you know. Whatever you need, it's like a warrior going to battle. You want to wear the best armor and have the best sword and or the whatever, you know, that you can have, you know. Or if you're running a race, you want to have the best pair of running shoes, you know, because you want to win that race. So if you're trying to, you know, attain enlightenment, then you want the best conditions for that, you know. So, and think about what they are. What do you need? You know, we talked about that earlier. What are my needs? You know? What am I lacking? What's missing? What is interfering me from doing the Dharma practice that I want to do? What is it? You know, might not know. And then identify what that is, and then work to overcome that. You know, like I keep saying, you have to start where you are with your baby steps. You know, I can only do it for 5 minutes. Well, why can't I do it only for 5 minutes? Well, because I work too hard, you know, or I don't get enough sleep, or I don't. So rather than trying to force that 5 minutes longer, look at what's not supporting that. You know, we always have to look at the big picture. You know, what's surrounding, what's the environment, the outer environment, you know, around our, because we have an outer environment, we also have an internal environment. The internal environment is our mind. And so we may even be retired and have all the leisure in the world. So the external environment's there. But our internal environment is just completely full of obstacles. You know, so it's like we have to clean inside too. We have to get the inner leisure inside. And whether that's with tapping or psychology or acupuncture or swimming, or because so much of that is just physical, because our winds are all clogged up because we've been working or we've been got, you know, psychological complexes or whatever. But so the necessary conditions is really not to be underrated, and to not think that things aren't impermanent. You know, things are impermanent, so conditions will change. And don't think that you're stuck. Everything's always moving. Conditions are always changing. And so it's good to, you know, make a list of your goals, what you'd like to change, what you'd like to see. And then include that in your dedications. This is what I want to have happen, you know. And it might not happen next year, you know, but it eventually, you know, because the thing we have to understand about Buddhism, there's no God out there making us have this experience. And even though we might not believe that intellectually, we still operate under that paradigm. And so we have to make sure that we create the paradigm that I create my reality. And if I can be creative enough and inspired enough, then I can create a body and mind of a Buddha. The only thing that's limiting is my sense of self. You know, my limited vision of myself is all that's stopping me. You know, and also my karma. So I need to change that. And we need to change that by, well, we've talked about all the ways, you know, we create merit and purify and request. Those are three things, you know. Purify, accumulate, request, you know. So now where are we? Excuse me, I drank some tea this morning, so I'm kind of charged up. let's see. Become acquainted with the three non-degenerations. Okay, well, you'd also think about what the degenerations are. But the non-degenerations are faith. So the opposite of that would be dispel doubt, you know. And how do we do that? You know, we do that by study. And I remember he's now the Ganden Tripa. I had the good fortune to be able to speak to him through one of his close students who speaks Tibetan. And his main advice to me was he just looked at me and he said, you have to be completely certain about the Lamrim. Completely, totally certain. And I realized, I guess I'm not about all things, you know. And so faith isn't the blind faith like we know about in, you know, Catholicism or, you know, but it's more born by first an intellectual understanding and then testing it. Remember Buddha always said, test it. To the point where you really believe if I create the cause, you know, all the stuff I've been talking about, it's just my words, but you have to internalize that and believe it yourself. If you want to get enlightened, you know, you have to have faith that you can, that faith in karma, that I can create the cause, you know, that there is a possibility of enlightenment. Everything is impermanent. Everything is empty. You know, it's got to be more than just intellectual. You have to really deeply understand it, you know. And, so I think there's three types of faith. There's clear faith, aspiring faith, and the faith of certainty. So clear faith means you know what it is. You know, we have to know what death impermanence is before we can have faith in it. You know, we have to study. And then get inspired. You know, I would like to have faith in that, you know. And then once you get that faith, and one of the non-degenerations is holding that understanding. Because what can happen is, you know, you see it often. You know, people get really involved in the Dharma for about 5 years, and then for some reason, you know, they didn't get the reward they wanted, or they just find something else. And I mean, that's okay. Karma changes, but they didn't. The understanding didn't take hold for whatever reason. You know, it's not that I'm not saying that's bad. You know, because maybe they decided that Hare Krishna works better for them, or they, like, I have a good friend who went back to the Catholic Church, and she's much happier there. So that's fine. You know, it's all the same thing eventually. You know, in some ways, I mean, at least in the Catholic Church, from our viewpoint, you're still creating lots of virtue. You know, and because she's a Buddhist. As a Catholic, I think it's real interesting. She still understands emptiness and understands God in that, but she just liked the rituals. It felt at home to her, and so she just felt much more comfortable going to a Catholic service than doing a tantric sadhana. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And she hasn't abandoned the Lam Rim or even her teachers. She just loves being a Catholic and having the community. So there's lots of ways, you know. And so. So holding that understanding and then effort. It does take effort. And we talked about that yesterday, about right effort. You can't overdo it and then burn out. I mean, you can. We all do. Not all of us anyway, but it is possible. So just always remember that rest is a virtuous activity. And if you need to rest for a month, like I would sometimes, well, I guess it's one time, I went to, you know, the master's program. They have this whole 7-year program at Lama Tsongkhapa Institute where people study for 7 years. And then all, like every, basically what's studied in the monasteries, what Geshe study. And then at the end of that, they have to do, I think it's a 6-month retreat. Maybe it's a year-long retreat. And so, yeah, and so Connie Miller, who knew me from a long time ago, she was running that program at the time. She invited me to come, and we spent a whole week. I was teaching them how to do retreat, you know, how to relax and everything. And they, the ones who did it, they said it was so, so helpful, you know, because, and the reason they did that is the year before, I mean, the 7 years before, all those people completely burned out in retreat and got bad lung and just didn't have, so she thought, oh, let's try this. And so I just taught all the stuff, you know, much longer, you know, all these things. You know, they learned Qigong, they learned about psychology and how to eat properly and all these things, you know, that support your Dharma practice. And, but one of the things I told them is the first thing you do is just don't do anything for a month. Just rest. Rest and enjoy yourself. And the people who had the best experiences in retreat, they told me later that's what they did and that's why. Because they were ready to start, you know. So even if it's just a week-long retreat, don't do anything the first day, you know. Just let yourself sleep, you know, because a tired mind, it's really hard to meditate and practice when you're tired, you know. So, I'll tell you another story. I'm kind of going over time, but that's all right, if you don't mind, as long as we finish by... because this is a great story too. The same, it wasn't Geshe Jampa Wangtu, it was Genla Rinpa, who was another Tibetan monk who achieved enlightenment in one lifetime. And he lived in a little tiny house. It was like probably one, maybe less than 2 meters by 2 meters, you know. Just a little, it was just, he had a bed. Maybe it was 2 meters by 2 meters because there was a bed and just enough, like that much space in front. It's a little tiny fireplace. And it was just this little mud hut that he built out by Trudhyam Rinpoche's stupa in McLeod Ganj. And I was very fortunate to get invited to go visit him once with Thupten Pemo and Tricia Donnelly. It was before she was ordained. Tricia's passed on now. And Tricia was, as she was for many years, she was director at the center in Delhi. And so she Asking the Rinpa through Pema's broken Tibetan. What could she do to help her stay up late because she was so tired at the end of her day she couldn't do her prayers? He just looked at her and he said, go to sleep. He said, this is where I learned this from. You know, I'm so glad I got to see him. Otherwise, I would have just charged through and, you know, but he said yogis, when they're in retreat, you know, real yogis sleep as much as they need to. And this thing about getting up before the crack of dawn and all that stuff, that's what monasteries do because they've got 500 monks they need to control, you know, and they're all wild Tibetan boys, you know. They're barbarians, you know. I mean, they're wild indigenous people, you know. I mean, that's not true. I'm exaggerating. But if, you know, if you're on your own, just sleep as much as you need to for as long as you need to. And the other thing he did is he made us all tea. And we had tea, and he had what he called white tea. And it was just hot water with milk powder in it. He didn't take any caffeine. And in my retreats, I never have either. Now, since I've moved to England, I've learned to like tea, but you can see it affects me. It's like I'm high on caffeine at the moment. But it makes me talk more. So then you have your real energy, you know, and you know how, because your mind, I mean, I'm probably okay if you have a little tea, you know, I'm not saying that, especially if it's a short retreat. You don't want to be going through caffeine withdrawals. But it's just good to feel your winds where they are, you know. And if you're tired, do more Qigong, you know, in the beginning of it. This is if you have a long retreat, you know. Because Qigong will give you energy, you know. The five Tibetans are really good at giving you energy. And also, I think the tapping. Because the more you do the tapping, the more you can... Because all those complexes take energy away from your body-mind, you know. So the more you can release them... the more psychic energy you have for your practice. So, where was that? Effort. So effort is something to really know that... And I would suggest reading the Sanjay Davis chapter on perseverance. It's really good. There's a book, I think it's called The Awakening Mind by Geshe Yeshe Topten. That's really good, of the Six Perfections. It's a Sanjay Davis book. Okay, I didn't think these would be so full on, but they are. Possess the three inseparables. Okay, so that you're never inseparable from a virtuous body, speech, and mind as best as you can. You know, the three, you hold close this attitude to have a virtuous body, speech, and mind. I train without bias towards the objects. That's obvious. Equanimity towards all beings, you know. You might like cats and not dogs, you know, so then you don't get the dog bone, you know, or you might like white people and not black people, or you might like men and not women, or you might like this person and not that person. So, and I didn't do any of those equanimity meditations, but they're also very helpful, you know, when you visualize the friend in front of you and you feel all your feelings for your friend, and then you move that and put the enemy and see what that feels like, and then you try to give the warm feelings you have to your friend towards your enemy and towards your stranger. Those are all in the Lam Rim. Really good. And oh, and just one other thing too. Lama said in our last teaching, we were watching videos of Lama, he said, don't expect to think that you have to get equanimity before you can move on to the next stage of developing bodhicitta. Because equanimity is going to take your whole lifetime. So just work at equanimity. And the other thing about equanimity is, it doesn't mean that you don't show more affection towards your family and your friends. I mean, that's normal. You have to. But it just means that inside, in your mind, you know that you have equally, or you're attempting to have equal love and affection for all beings. But it doesn't discount the karmic relationships we have with people. Now, so that doesn't mean we should be less affectionate with our close people, you know, or have to be more affectionate with strangers, you know. Like going and hugging everybody, you know, you don't have to do that. Not that an English person would. A Californian, maybe. Okay. Train without bias towards the objects. Well, that just means having preconceived notions about things. Let's see what Geshe-Rapta says about that. I don't see it here. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Let's keep going. We know what that means, you know. It's important to train deeply and encompass all. So that means study the Lamrim. And encompassing all means understand that emptiness underlies everything and that no matter what we do, we need to continually chip away, you know, at our concrete concepts of self and others as best as we can. You know, like Lama Zopa says all the time, when you're walking around, you know, just tell yourself that what I'm seeing is a projection of my mind, you know. It's completely colored by all my preconceptions, you know. This is a dream, you know, as much as we can. Like, put it in your car, you know, this is a dream. Put it on your bathroom mirror, you know. Put it in your kitchen, you know, this is a dream. Because it's hard to remember that, because it's just not our habit. Always meditate on special cases. I think we talked about that one yesterday, that it's always harder to practice with the people we're the closest to. So those are the special cases. Or people that we have a particularly aversion towards. You know, there are some people that just drive us crazy. You know, so those are our objects of practice. You know. Do not rely upon other conditions. That's like, oh, I'll wait until I have, like, saved up $50,000 before I go off and do a retreat. Or I'll wait until, you know, I don't work as much before I start practicing. Or I'll wait until, you know, waiting for other conditions. Because we just have to practice. You know, I know previously I said you can pray and have good conditions and this kind of things. But whatever we end up with, we just have to work with that, you know. Because I know that one of the things that some people who want to do long retreat, Roger Kunsong, Lama Zopa's attendant, was saying that, you know, their big excuse is they haven't found the right place yet, you know. And sometimes you just have to take what you can get. You know, if you really want to, do a particular practice, don't wait until it's just the right situation. You know, just, and practice wherever you are, you know. And who is on the bus, you know, on the tube, you know. I'm just kind of like, if you have a really busy life, don't wait until, you know, to the weekend, you know. Just do something every day, you know. Apply the principal practice at this time, and don't waste your perfect human rebirth. Just really remember that. That thing about Fort Knox, you know. I've just got this one chance. You know, what is the golden turtle? I mean, the golden yolk in the ocean and the turtle that comes up every 100 years. Can you think about how that is? You know, that's like one in a trillion chances that we have this connection with the Buddha this lifetime. And the other thing I don't think I've mentioned, but Lama Zopa would mention, is that part of our dedications is to pray to meet with Dharma in the future lives. I don't think I said that yet. You know, may we always, I think it's in the end of the succession Guru Yoga, may I always be able to meet with the Dharma and good conditions. You know, because you don't want to be born right now in Tibet. You might meet with the Dharma, but there's no way, it's very difficult to practice there. You know. So. I mean, maybe a great bodhisattva would wish to be born in Tibet, but, you know, and another thing is, you know, one of these here is like don't bite off more than you can chew either, you know that saying. So then we have, do not misinterpret. That means don't apply the wrong, you know, patience at the wrong time. Like, don't be patient when you need to actually change your situation, you know, and don't have grandmother compassion, where you endure some sort of abominable behavior from someone, rather than saying stop. You know, idiot compassion. We're all plagued by that. You know, we so want to, and part of it's a worldly dharma. You know, we don't want to be seen as a bad person, or we don't want to upset that person. But in actual fact, you know, it's like if someone's an abuser, you don't just stay there and let them abuse you because you're trying to be a compassionate Buddhist. You know, that's wrong compassion. You know, if you're in a really bad situation and you're trying to, you know, you're staying in it, that's wrong compassion, you know. So, yeah. So those kind of things. Don't twist things. And the next one is don't be erratic. We've talked about that, you know. Don't say, oh, you know, I practice 2 days and then I wait a month and then I practice 2 days. That's why I said take something small. Take something that you could actually do every day, you know, and do that. Even if it's just motivating in the morning and dedicating in the evening, you know, and do a little breathing when you're on the tube, you know. Little and stable is better than big and erratic. It's like that with anything. If you're learning to sing, you have to sing 15 minutes a day. If you're learning to play piano, you got to play piano 15 minutes every day. You know, anything. Because it comes back to all Dharma practice is changing our habits. And that's why where the five forces come in. You know, we have to have the will and habituate ourselves to it. It's just mental habits that we're changing. The same with like getting yourself to exercise every day. It's just getting yourself. And the thing is, you have to be inspired enough to want to do it. So, and now we have like YouTube and all these things, you know, if you're feeling a little bit down or uninspired, just, you know, watch Osel. He's great, you know. Put in Osel Hita or put in Lama Zopa Rinpoche or Dalai Lama. I mean, there's a TV channel that shows Dalai Lama all the time. Like I have a friend who's he's like an insurance broker or something, and he does medical insurance. He's really busy. But he's got this, I think it's great, he's got this massage chair, you know. He comes home from a busy day, he gets in his massage chair, puts on his big TV, and watches the Dalai Lama. And that's how he comes home from work, you know. And he's too tired to meditate, but he sits there and he gets his massage and he watches Dalai Lama. I just think that's fantastic, you know. So, why not, right? He's got one of those giant TVs, you know.
I said amazing.
Yeah. I just think that's really smart. He is really smart. And then don't be erratic. Oh, and I've got a little note here about to training without bias. Also means, and I guess I wrote that for myself, like don't just do it to please other people or do it for people you enjoy or, you know, just do it because... And also, train without bias also towards your conditions. Like, you know, oh, the weather's not so good today, so I don't think I'll practice, or I don't like this place, or, you know, those kind of things. We're getting there. train with certainty. Well, we already talked about that, how you have to develop faith and have strong certainty. Be released by 2, investigation and analysis. We've talked about that too, that they talk about, you know, you listen to teachings, you contemplate the teachings, and then you meditate on the teachings. So it's important to continue to study. You know, it's kind of, you know, in the West, it's like, you know, we study biology once and we never see it again. We study psychology once, we never see it again. We study English and we never study that again. But with Dharma, I mean, Dalai Lama's probably received the Lam Rim hundreds of times. You know, Lama Zopa tells us the same thing over and over and over again, because it's like I said the very first day, it's three-dimensional learning, it's not two-dimensional learning. And it's a constant process of changing behavior, changing habits. And so, because the brain, you know, it's just a matter of, I mean, who's that guy who wrote, there's a new Buddhist guy who's writing about the brain. No, like Buddha's brain. You know that guy, Buddha's brain?
Rick Hansen.
Mm. His book, especially his second book, which I can't remember the name of it. I read it a couple of years ago. It's all about the science of all it is we have to get enough new neural pathways so that we overcome the old ones. And that's all purification is, really. But it's the merit. This is the secret that I think the West doesn't understand, is this concept of karma and merit. That it's not just changing the pathways. You know, you also have to, in order to change those pathways, you have to have the merit to do that. So that's why we have to do it over and over and over again, investigate and analysis, because we have to, we have to do it, you know, like a mantra. And the other thing that's really important is to put it in your own words. You know, you can read a Lam Rim book, but go away and think about it. You know, that's another thing retreat's good for. And pretend that, like what I used to do is, I love my sister, you know, and she's not interested in Dharma very much. I mean, she's a good person. Like a lot of my friends, they're virtuous people, but they couldn't care less about practicing Dharma, and that's fine. But I used to pretend that I was trying to explain it to her. You know, why do we need a teacher? What is guru devotion? You know, what's a perfect human rebirth? What's karma? And I found that helped me understand it, which is why I think now people say, you know, I can explain things. I can explain things for a kindergartner because I'm a kindergartner. You know, I was reading that book, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, you know. The teaching on emptiness in here, I can't understand it at all. It's just all this, it's too intellectual for me, you know. It's too much philosophy, you know. And it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, some people love that stuff. You know, all the Vaibhishikas and the Chittamantras and the tenets and all that stuff, you know. And even that's easy to understand if you distill it down into, you know, the Reader's Digest version. Do you have Reader's Digest in this country?
Yeah, I don't know if we still do.
But you know what I mean, making it simple. So this one's really important, you know, to do the investigation and analysis and read lots of different... There's so many Lam Rim books out now, you know. I really like the words of my perfect teacher.
Yeah.
You know, I don't particularly like our Pabongka Rinpoche one, the Liberation of the Palm of Your Hand, because it's meant for like naughty monk boys. And so it's full of punitive, blame, shame language, which doesn't help us. I'm sorry to say. I mean, excuse me, Pabongka Rinpoche. I mean, you can read it because there's a lot of great teachings in there, really. I mean, actually, the teachings on emptiness in that book are really good, and the teachings on the 7-point mind training in that book are really good. But you just have to temper it with an understanding who his audience was. It wasn't 21st century educated Western people, you know. It was monks that can't read, you know. Monks that grew up on a farm, you know, who walked to Lhasa, you know. And they needed that teaching by fear. You know, we don't need to be taught with fear. Fear just compounds our complexes. We have enough shame and blame. So when you read these old books, these Tibetan texts that use fear to teach, just re-translate it, because the other bits are quite good. You just have to not hear it that way. Because if you have any of that stuff, it'll just stir it up, you know. Yeah, so where are we now?
The other texts, as well as Liberation and Palm of Your Hand,
The words of my perfect teacher. There's a lot of good. Geshe Zopa's Lam Rims. There's one called The Easy Path. It's very new. It's really good. By Kensar Lodzang Jampa Rinpoche. And it's edited by Lauren Ladner. It's a... Lauren's an old friend. And he also wrote that book, The Lost Art of Compassion. But anyway, it's really good because, for one thing, it's not long. You know, and the other thing is that at the end of every chapter, you know, death and impermanence, whatever, he gives a meditation. And they're always involving rainbow lights and stuff like that. So that's the book that Lama Zopa is giving people these days. And it's only about 3 or 4 years old, and it's quite contemporary. He's giving it to people in Virginia, I think, in the U.S. So that's a good Lam Rim book. Another Lam Rim book I like is, there's Essential Nectar, which is Geshe Rapton. But there's also one called Essence of Nectar by Losang Sondru, T-S-O-N-D-R-U, and it's a commentary by Geshe Tarchin. And it's an old book. It's been around since we were beginners, isn't it? It's been around since the 70s. But I've always liked that book because it's also very, very short. It's just like one or two pages of every topic of the Lam Rim. So if you're wanting to take Lama Zopa's advice, which is study a little bit of Lam Rim every day, if you have that book, when you sit down to meditate in the morning, you can just read that chapter. You know, read, because it does. It just takes you like 2 minutes to read it. And then you can start your morning, you know, maybe you've done your little breathing thing and, you know, refuge, and then you can do, you know, 5-10 minutes of contemplation on Lam Rim. And I lost a whole bunch of books when I moved up to Shetland. They got lost in the mail. So I have to buy them all again, if you can still get that book. I don't know. It's a Library of Tibetan Works and Archives. But I really like that one. And the library here has lots of Lam Rim books, so have a peruse of the books. And okay. Do not be boastful. Well, that's easy. I mean, it's not easy, but it's easy to understand, you know. And, you know, there's kind of a line between rejoicing and boastful, you know. Because sometimes I'll be rejoicing and people think I'm bragging, but I'm just rejoicing. So I have to be careful, you know. Yeah, especially because, like, my life's gotten better. So I'm, like, happy, you know. It's like, well, I have a better place to live. Yeah, you know. But I'm not boasting about it. I'm just rejoicing, you know. So be careful, though, because people might misinterpret. Do not get angry. Easy. I mean, not easy, but easy to understand. Do not be unstable. And do not wish for gratitude. Yeah. So that's it. So then we can say, because of my many wishes, having endured suffering and a bad reputation, I receive the instructions for controlling self-grasping. Now, if I die, I have no regrets. So let's, you know, it's wonderful, isn't it? So I thought I'd ask Barbara to read the rejoicing again, so we can just sit here and rejoice that we've studied this and we've talked about it and, you know, we've made friends and ate good food and got a good night's sleep, hopefully.
And good discussions.
We had great discussions. I really appreciate all of you for not being too shy.
Is it long enough space in between
four? I thought so, yes.
Yeah. Right, the actual practice. The first one is on self. First, rejoice in all of the good things you yourself have done in the past. Think of what you must have done in past lives to result in this precious human life today. Practicing generosity, morality, patience, and making stainless pure prayers. Every good thing you experience now is the result of past positive actions you have done. As you are reflecting on the good things you must have done in the past, rejoice by reciting to yourself like a mantra, "How wonderful it is, how wonderful it is." Rejoice in all the good things, sincere prayers, practices, helping others, following your teacher's advice, etc., that you are doing in this present life, thinking, how wonderful it is, how wonderful it is.
Then rejoice in all the virtuous activities you will do in the future, all the realizations on the path you will develop, and all the ways you will help others, teach the Dharma, etc. Thinking, how wonderful it is. How wonderful it is. The next section is on others. Now, think of all the wonderful things others have done, all their virtuous qualities, and the ways people have helped one another in the past, are helping each other now, and will do so in the future. Especially all of your companions in the spiritual life, thinking, how wonderful it is. How wonderful it is. Also of particular qualities that others have, such as generosity, intelligence, beauty, fame, wealth, devotion, etc. Thinking, how wonderful it is. How wonderful it is. About the life stories of the various saints of all the different religious traditions and how they benefited others through devoting their lives to spiritual practice and service. Rejoice in their qualities and deeds, thinking, how wonderful it is. How wonderful it is. Section is on the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Continue by thinking specifically of all the incredible things that have been done in the past, are being done now, and will be done in the future by all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, including your own teachers and the lineage lamas. Remember their qualities, their life stories, the hardships they bore to generate realization in their minds and to preserve the Dharma, and how they have helped countless living beings, thinking, how wonderful it is, how wonderful it is. Now, allow your mind to be completely aware of and rejoice in all the wonderful things that yourself, others, and all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have done, are doing, and will do from now until all beings reach enlightenment. Remember how lucky you are, we all are, to have met the Dharma, met wonderful teachers, and begin to understand that everything is dependent arising. Feel expansive and happy for yourself and others, thinking how wonderful it is, how wonderful it is.
Did I ask you to read one more thing?
Yeah, I had it that last week, by the way.
No, that's fine.
Because I knew you did it.
We read this the first day, and I thought it'd be nice to hear it the last day, just to kind of review it. And while you read that, I'm going to get the gold books, because I want to do Shanti Davis thing too. So, yeah.
Right, this is, it's stated in the Array of Tree Trunks Sutra. O child of my family, the awakening mind is like the seed of all the teachings of the Buddhas. It is like the field in which the positive actions of all wandering beings prosper. It is like the earth on which the whole world depends. It is like the sun of the Lord of Wealth, who completely eliminates all kinds of poverty. It is like the Father, completely protecting all bodhisattvas. It is like the king of wish-granting jewels, which perfectly fulfills every purpose. It is like the miraculous vase, which acts to accomplish every wish. It is like the spear accomplishing the foe of disturbing emotions. It is like the armor guarding you from improper thoughts. It's like a sword beheading the disturbing emotions. It is like an axe felling the tree of disturbing emotions. It is like a weapon staving off all kinds of attack. It is like the hook which draws you out of the waters of cyclic existence. It is like the whirlwind which scatters all mental obstructions and their sources. It is like the condensed teaching that encompasses all affairs and activities of the Bodhisattvas. It is like the shrine before which all the gods, humans and demigods of the world can present their offerings. O child of my family, the awakening mind is endowed like this, with these and immeasurable other excellent qualities.
It's nice, isn't it? Okay, so we're going to do a little more dedication because it's always good to dedicate at the end. So turn to page 246 and this gold book. Everybody have it? May all, we'll read it all together. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled, with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored upon finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Amazing, huh? That's the Dalai Lama's favorite prayer, that last bit. For as long as space remains, sentient beings, may I too remain. He's probably been saying that for many, many lifetimes. So we have another one that I'd like to do. It's on page 263. This is one of my favorite prayers. The final Lamrim dedication. From my two collections, vast as space, that I have amassed from working with effort at this practice for a great length of time, may I become the chief leading Buddha for all those whose mind's wisdom eye is blinded by ignorance. Even if I do not reach this state, may I be held in your loving compassion for all my lives, Manjushri. May I find the best of the complete great paths of the teachings, and may I please all the Buddhas by my practice, using skillful means drawn by the strong force of compassion. May I clear the darkness from the minds of all beings. With the points of the path as I have discerned them, may I uphold the Buddha's teachings for a very long time. With my heart going out with great compassion, in whatever direction the most precious teachings have not yet spread or once spread have declined, may I reveal this treasure of happiness and aid. May the minds of those who wish for liberation be granted bounteous peace, and the Buddha's deeds be nourished for a very long time. By even this great path to enlightenment completed due to the wondrous virtuous conduct of the Buddhas and their sons. May all human and non-human beings who eliminate adversity and create conducive conditions for practicing the excellent paths never be parted in any of their lives from the purest path praised by the Buddhas. Whenever someone makes effort to act in accordance with the tenfold Mahayana virtuous practices, may they always be assisted by the mighty ones, and may oceans of prosperity spread everywhere. And so again, we rejoicing and remembering that myself is empty. All this good karma we created this weekend is also empty, depending on causes and conditions. And all the sentient beings that we are offering to, the enlightenment of all sentient beings, also do not exist from their own side. And this act of giving also is arising dependent on myself and what I'm giving and who I'm giving it to. So there is not one ounce of inherent existence in any of this activity, nor where there was in any of the activity this whole weekend, or whatever it was, 4 days. So we just rejoice and offer that up with whatever spacious imagination of emptiness we have, just offer that up. And then remembering that subtle wind in mind, the center of my heart, that is inseparable with the subtle wind in mind of all the Buddhas. We all have the same potential. We'll read the little, we'll chant the dedication that we have on our sheet too. Visualizing that all that virtue is going on and touching all sentient beings. By this virtue may I become Buddha. But increase forevermore. And dedicating for the long lives of all the teachers and for all the Sangha to have the conditions they need and all beings everywhere. It's okay, come in, to have everything they need to elect wise and compassionate leaders for the people of Tibet to have better conditions, and all indigenous peoples that are being pushed out by the steady growth of civilization. May there be some kind of preserve so some they can keep their way of life. It's so precious, you know. Because I think indigenous people have something, that's not a really nice word for them, but I don't know what to say, just normal people living the way they lived prior to the Industrial Revolution, the pockets of them, you know, they hold something very special, which is a spiritual life all day long. You know, they without calling it emptiness or whatever you call it, they have a connection to each other, to the earth, to the elements, to the animals, and they feel it. And there's magic in their world, you know. And whatever that is that they have, I know it's going to be wiped out eventually, but may somehow that understanding of the universe that's beyond materialism, they may not have the, you know, Buddhist intellectual, whatever, you know, but still they have something very special. And may they be able to continue to live in their rainforests and their deserts, and even Tibetan people, you know, there's not much left. So, you know, we need to preserve our endangered species and our endangered planet, but there's also endangered cultures, and Tibetan Buddhism is one of them. Preserving endangered cultures for those that, if we do survive the next 50 to 100 years, there's something other than consumption materialism left of human society, where people value spirit and value connection and value the earth and value the planets and value things that make human life meaningful. Because this modern materialistic world just makes depressed, uptight people. And we need to go beyond that. And so whatever seed of that we have in our own mind, you know, in our connection with our own Celtic roots or wherever you're from, you know, may we kindle that and remember that and try to keep that spirit of magic and mystery and awe and wonder about the way the universe works. May we be able to keep that alive as we march towards insanity more and more and more. So thanks a lot. It's been a nice weekend. And
thank you.
Yeah.